From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We are mothers, fathers, sisters, brothers, and family members who can't sleep at night because the state has virtually abandoned our loved ones.
It's like, I'm a human being, these people are human beings, and we have to sit here and beg for help? That's not right.
My little girl is named Jessica. She hasn't been home in 2 years. She's a ventilator-dependent quadriplegic. I don't know. Please, I want my daughter back home.
I'm saying I believe that the majority of the General Assembly is using them as props right now. Instead of doing what they should be doing, negotiating a balanced budget in Springfield, they're going out and I think taking advantage of those who are being hurt.
He should know that people on the West Side have been living on the concrete and living in the dirt for a very long time, and now he wants them to die.
In 18 years that I have served as a state representative, I have never heard statements like that made in a public hearing.
I think we should all be mad as hell at the governor of this state and run him out of this state, because this is not one of his businesses that he could drive in the hole, tear down, and try to build it up for the rich people.
I'm not here to have a political bashing of one person, because we all know there are four leaders and there's 118 of us in the House and 59 in the Senate. And it's up to all of us to come up with that budget and give it to the governor.
Some of the comments from an Illinois House hearing this week on the state budget impasse and the impact it's having. A judge also told the state of Illinois it needs to do something about that big backlog of Medicaid bills. We'll talk about those issues and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Joining me in studio as well with Charlie is Brian Mackey, our Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. And in Chicago by phone today, Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business. He's a political writer for them. Greg, it's good to have you on again.
My pleasure, guys.
And Brian and Greg, I'm going to start with you because you both were covering this issue this week. That Medicaid ruling, we previewed it a bit last week. Brian, I'll start with you, I guess. What happened in that ruling? What did the judge have to say?
The judge basically says that Illinois is not paying its Medicaid providers fast enough, which violates a court decree. They are being paid during the impasse. There was a consent decree dating back to the 1990s because Illinois wasn't doing a good enough job of fulfilling its obligations for people back then. And so even though the state is paying these, it's doing so after it's paying state employee paychecks. It's doing it after it makes its pension payments, after it repays bondholders. And there's just not enough money coming in to satisfy all these demands. And so Medicaid providers are in some cases six months, I believe, behind. And they want that sped up. The judge did not order the checks to be cut immediately or anything like that, which could have precipitated an immediate crisis in government beyond the one we already have. But she did give the state and the Medicaid organizations, the companies that are providing these services, just I think until June 20th to come up with some kind of agreement or solution.
And Greg, there was no clarity as far as what might happen on June 20th, or do we have a better idea of that?
No, the judge indicated that she wants a solution. She wants something that gives some relief to those who filed suit. And I don't blame them. If I were owed money for 6 months and was trying to operate a social service agency, I'd be a little ticked off too. The problem is there's not enough money. We're in a hole as a state, and we're getting hundreds of millions of dollars further in the hole every single month now. So until they work this out, it's going to be harder and harder and harder to pay the bills. Susana Mendoza, the controller, says she feels like a triage surgeon, and she's right. She's got to decide whether you're going to provide blood, in this case, to the right arm and the left leg. I mean, at a certain point, it just falls apart.
And Greg, can you explain why the judge would have this authority to say to the state of Illinois, put these bills higher than some other bills?
Medicaid is half the money comes from the federal government, so there's jurisdiction in the federal courts. In addition, there's civil rights questions that cover this. There's an argument here that the people were being mistreated here, mostly poor and minority. And beyond that, there have been past court cases and past agreements. So it's kind of you have a trifecta here. There's all kinds of reasons the federal courts can get involved.
Charlie, there's been more action happening in the courts, it seems, over the last couple of years than there has been at the State House itself, and this just goes right to that point.
Yeah, the state is operating on what we've called autopilot, and we're spending money to the neighborhood of $5, $6 billion more than we have coming in. And this particular case that the judge was dealing with was roughly $2 billion owed mostly to managed care companies that provide, that basically pay the doctors and the nurses and the people who treat low-income and senior citizens and people with disabilities. And the problem is that the providers, the doctors, are starting to not see Medicaid patients anymore, or they're telling these folks, well, I'll treat you, but you have to pay up front because I can't wait to be paid by the managed care company who's waiting to be paid by the state. And so there's a real concern that folks are going to lose their ability to access medical care. And that's one of the things that I think is probably going through the judge's mind. If this were the matter of some multi-billion dollar corporation that's going to have to wait a little bit, the judge probably would have said, take a walk. But because of the impact on real live human beings among the people who are on the margins of society, she's basically going to tell the state, look, you have to give them the same kind of precedence, the same kind of concern that you do to paying state workers' salaries.
And speaking of state workers' salaries, I guess that's one of those things some people have talked about could be impacted if the state has to push a lot of Medicaid payments up front. They may not have enough money to make the payroll. There has been some talk of that. Do we have any idea if it could come to that?
Well, the controller says that's exactly the problem. So that the payroll is going out because of a state judge, or I should say a county judge, really, in St. Clair County's orders. That case is being appealed through the system. There's an appellate court argument coming up on that. But so then the controller is going to have to decide, okay, do I violate the federal judge's orders on Medicaid? Do I violate the state judge's orders on employee payroll? Do I violate my constitutional obligation to make the pension payments? Do I violate statutory and constitutional obligations to make these bond payments? And she's going to be, and I think the federal judge called it an unenviable position to have to decide what to do there.
And you talked to Susana Mendoza, and I thought she had this very interesting quote in that interview in which she said, I shouldn't have this much power.
Right. That's exactly it. She says, you know, if the General Assembly and the governor had actually done their jobs and passed a budget, she wouldn't be in this position to decide the winners and losers. And, you know, what she ends up doing is people come to her and say, okay, we run this social service agency. We're going to be, you know, we have to close because we can't even make payroll for the next month. She can try and expedite that payment. But that's about the extent of what she can do without a real budget. She made the point, you look at her website, there's every day it shows the amount of money that comes into the general fund and how much is spent. The bill backlog is over 14, almost approaching $15 billion. And on the most recent day, they spent about $14 million. So just a tiny fraction of the money that the state of Illinois is already obligated to spend.
Yeah, and I think I'd like to interject here. We keep talking about, oh, we need a budget. That kind of glosses over the reality of the situation. A budget basically is authority to spend money, an appropriation bill. It tells some agency, some entity, you can spend up to this much from this fund for this purpose. You could have all the appropriation authority you wanted, but if there's no money there, it doesn't do any good. That's why the schools are waiting for their categorical grant payments to the tune of, what, $1 billion or so. What you need is the revenue. You need to raise more revenue. You need to raise taxes. That's the bottom line. And to me, I think it's not helpful in the long run when politicians keep talking about, oh, we need a budget, without saying we need to increase taxes to pay our bills.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that. I think everybody in Springfield is kind of the belief that we're not going to get a big budget deal with revenue in the remainder of this month. That's highly unlikely. That the most we'll probably get is another stopgap budget, which is exactly what Charlie was just talking about. It's the authority to spend money that you don't have. Now, in some cases, you can borrow, but the bond agencies, one of them, S&P during the week, pretty much said that, hey, if we don't have a budget, a real budget by the end of the month, we're going to put Illinois dead into junk. That has all kinds of complications. At a minimum, it makes it more expensive to try to borrow money to pay off some of these bills. At a certain point, and I don't know when that point is, but at a certain point, you literally have to decide between which group of people are going to starve and which group of people are going to go without food on the table, and which group are not going to be able to see the doctor. It's that severe, and it's getting worse. And until they work this out, it's only going to become harder and harder.
Well, yesterday, I guess it was on Thursday, there was a hearing that took place. The Illinois House Democrats primarily involved in this, putting this together, in which they had a lot of people who came forward who talked about being victims of the budget impasse and funding for different services being cut. A lot of tears, a lot of anger in that type of hearing. But we've heard this. I don't want to downplay that, but we have heard this for months, actually going into 2 years now, and that hasn't seemed to move the needle at all. It doesn't seem to me like that's going to make any difference. It's only going to take court orders, most likely, or maybe some uprising of rank and file members of the legislature. But otherwise, I don't know that anything like that's going to help the situation.
It certainly hasn't seemed to move the public consciousness. Most people in polls have said that they're not affected by the budget impasse because they don't have somebody who gets mental health services from the state, or they don't have a child who is disabled and needs 24-hour medical care helped to be paid for by the state. And so there was, as you said, tears. Republicans and Democrats expressed sympathy. We even heard some outrage. Representative LaShawn Ford, we heard at the top of the show, called for the recall of the governor. But that doesn't really advance, like you said, Sean, it doesn't really advance the discussions in terms of a budget, because the core problem remains that Governor Rauner says he would vote for or would sign off on a higher tax rate if the Democrats go along with his agenda, which has varied over the years, but recently has included property tax freeze, changes to the workers' compensation system, things like that. The Democrats say, we've done a little of that, and anymore it would hurt the middle class. We're not going to go along with it. And frankly, the Democrats don't like the idea of tying these things to the budget process anyway. And so that's where we've been for 2.5 years, and that's where it seems like we're going to remain indefinitely, unless there is some sort of mass change in awareness in the state.
The governor,
I don't know.
And the governor did talk this week, I guess, throughout at least the possibility, at least that's the way it was reported, of a special session calling lawmakers back to town to deal with the budget. Does anybody that were on this panel here think that that would solve the issue if they got them all back under the Capitol?
No, that's just another effort by him to look like he's doing something while he's out on the campaign trail. What good does it do to call 118 representatives and 59 senators back if there's nothing for them to vote on?
There is one thing on the agenda that could grab the public consciousness, to use a phrase that was just used here. And that is the possibility of not having a budget so that schools don't open in the fall, or I guess it's August in some parts of the state. That was solved last year by passing the stopgap budget. The governor has said that this year he's not going to sign another stopgap budget unless it includes the property tax freeze. It's one of his agenda items. But he's also indicated that, I'm not going to let the schools not open. Well, I think he's kind of got himself out on a limb on this one. Either he's going to have to give on the stopgap budget, or he's going to have to stand by and watch the schools not open, which would, heck no, who knows who the public would really blame there. But again, if you don't have the money to pay the schools at a certain point, it becomes meaningless. Yes, you have the authority to do it, but if there's no money in the Treasury, what are you going to do? Take it from the Medicaid people? We just talked about that.
And I think that's a great point, Greg, because this goes to why this impasse has avoided not being sort of the government shutdowns that we see in Washington, where they close the national parks. You can't get into the Smithsonian Museum. You see the images of school bus kids on school buses being turned away on their field trips, and veterans trying to get into the World War II Memorial, but there's barricades. We haven't had that in Illinois, unless you are a low-income student who gets a grant to go to public university, or you've been laid off from one of the state universities, or you're one of these human service recipients. And so that is a good point. If the schools ever, there were to be a sort of school shutdown, it would certainly raise awareness. But as Greg said, I'm not sure who would be blamed at this point. The governor has invested so much in making House Speaker Madigan the sort of root of everything that's wrong in state government. And he certainly has enough money and resources to put an ad campaign up if that were to happen, blaming Democrats for this. And I think that would be an interesting situation. And I don't know, like we said, I don't know who would wear the jacket for that.
I suspect one of the things that might occur would be that the average citizen who suddenly can't send their kid to school would say a pox on both their houses. Rauner is an evil, rotten, despicable human being, and Madigan is right behind him. And you are my state representative, and what the heck are you going to do about it? And there would be incredible pressure brought on local senators and local representatives, and the people that are bought and paid for by Rauner will have to go and tell him, look, we got to do something. The people who are under Madigan's control would have to go and tell him, look, we got to do something. And that's, in my mind, is where the solution lies. Rank-and-file legislators. In the opening clip, was that Patty Bellock who talked about there's 118, a Republican representative from the suburbs, there's 118 of us in the House, 59 in the Senate. Those are the people who've got to get up the backbone and tell their leadership, why don't you guys go out in the backyard, put on boxing gloves, and beat the living bejesus out of each other? We'll do the state's business.
And you could sell tickets to that possibly. That would help the state.
If you could have a referendum to fire both Bruce and Mike, it would pass overwhelmingly.
Well, and I'd like to think that we might see a point here where they're going to say where they would say we're not going to be able to come to an agreement. So let's do something to make sure government is funded for the foreseeable future. I guess another stopgap, at least it provides some certainty. But you almost feel as though they're going to walk that right up to the edge as well, that's not going to happen anytime soon.
And it doesn't do any good to do a pass a stopgap budget unless there's money to pay for it.
Well, and that's a good point, Drew, because literally it was one thing to pass a stopgap a year ago to keep the schools open because we did still have enough money to – but as you said, we're $1 billion behind in some of the education payments. And so there is just – And if depending on how this Medicaid ruling goes, depending on how the state employee, there's a lot of plates spinning right now, keeping this impasse going that could come to a head in the coming months. And we haven't even begun to talk about what the rating agencies have done and whether junk bond status will move anyone here in Illinois. I feel like people have been hearing about that for so long. I'm not sure that it necessarily would, but there's just a lot of shoes that can still drop this summer.
Go ahead, Greg and Brian. Why don't if you want to touch on that as far as what happened this week in the credit markets?
Well, yeah, and Greg probably is better steeped in this than I am, given where he works. But it was actually last week that two agencies downgraded the state, and there have been the bond market. There was a kind of after this Medicaid ruling, I think it's called the spread on bonds. Basically, Illinois bonds are seen as a much riskier bet than other typical government bonds. And it's the idea, and I think Reuters had a report on this, is that the markets are finally kind of waking up to the fact that Illinois may legit. I mean, we've said on this program, Illinois is not going to default on its bonds. When I interviewed Controller Mendoza, she wanted to not only make that point, but after the interview was over, she said, we really need to make that. I want to make sure I was clear about that. We are going to be good. You know, Illinois will do everything in her power to make good on its debt, because if you lose credibility with Wall Street, you're toast. You can't get any sort of financing or anything in the future. Sure. So she was very clear about that. But if there's all these other demands on our money, what's going to happen?
That's the key point. In theory, moving to junk bond status only means that you have to pay more for debt, maybe an exorbitant amount more. At a certain point, you say, "Oh my goodness, we can't be paying 8-9% for what's supposed to be 2 or 3%." But in issuing this warning earlier in the week, S&P used the magic word liquidity. In other words, will there be enough money there to pay financial obligations like bonds? That means default or deferrals or whatever, and that's what Susana Mendoza was hinting at. I mean, let me give you a scenario here. The federal judge comes in, Judge Lefkoe comes in and says, well, sorry, the Medicaid stuff is top priority, you got to put them at the top of the list. That's a lot of money. Does that leave you enough money to pay your debt service on time? I don't know. At a certain point, this goes back to Charlie's point, at a certain point, it falls apart. You can't meet your obligations, and somebody who really can do something about it gets screwed. It's a really horrendous situation, and you would like to think that there's going to be this big revolt among the backbenchers. I haven't seen it yet, but it could get really hairy here in a few months.
Charlie, you've talked for years about how no matter what the going rate is and everything, that investing in an Illinois state bond is really about as safe as it gets. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I still do. And the, you know, quotation mark smart money guys will be looking at this. I think the spread now is such that you can get interest on Illinois general obligation bonds maybe twice the interest that you could earn on, say, GO bonds from Minnesota. And they look at it as a way to make money relatively risk-free, because the last time Illinois defaulted on bonds was back in the 1840s. The statutory language is such that the legislature can't even amend the law to say we're going to defer these bond payments. And so what will happen is the comptroller, I suspect, will have to delay making the transfer, say, into the pension funds and to be able to pay the bondholders. The bondholders will be protected.
They're right off the top.
Right off the top, yeah. And even though if we have to pay out this money that's owed to the healthcare providers, the judge, I think, was indicating you don't have to do it all immediately. You have to have some plan to whittle it down.
I did want to save a few minutes here to talk politics, because we had yet another Democrat who has entered the race for governor, Representative Scott Drury. Brian, fill us in on him.
Yeah, he's about as backbench as you can get based on something he did earlier this year in the Illinois House of Representatives. He voted present for when the vote for Speaker was taken. He sort of made a show of saying that he was considering running for Speaker. I don't think he ever put his name in the running for nomination, but he is the first Democrat in a generation, really. I think Frank Martino's father was the last time that I found a Democrat who had voted present when Speaker Madigan was up for being Speaker of the House. He was punished for that. He did not get a fancy clock that the Speaker gave as gifts to people. And so this is sort of his main claim to fame. He's taken a few votes that sort of diverged from the party line in Springfield, and he says that he's also been critical of Governor Rauner, so he's hoping to find some sort of middle path. Interestingly, he announced his candidacy the very same day that the state's AFL-CIO endorsed J.B. Pritzker, so maybe got some of the air taken out of his announcement that day.
And does Drury change this race in any way, Greg? I mean, especially when you look at the money that Pritzker and Kennedy certainly would have to put into this, can he make any difference? Can he make an inroad there?
Yes, but it depends on whether he gets money himself. Without money, all he kind of does is split the anti-Madigan vote within the Democratic primary. Daniel Biss, the state senator from Evanston, has been critical of Mr. Madigan. Chris Kennedy, the Chicago business guy, has been critical of Madigan. Alderman Poir from Chicago has been kind of saying that as well. If one of them is going to emerge as the big challenger to J.B. Pritzker, who has said nothing negative about Madigan, somebody's going to have to consolidate that point, that vote at some point. This just splits it a little bit further. He can't do that, though, without financial assets. He does have some people who've given him money in the past that are kind of interesting. And Rich Miller over at Capital Facts pointed out that that Blair Hull, the wealthy commodities trader, has been one of his donors in the past. So is Ken Griffin, the governor's buddy. Does any of us think that it's beyond the pale that the governor would call his friend up and his friend would give a bunch of money to one of the Democratic guys to try and embarrass J.B. Pritzker? I don't. So let's wait and see. A little too early to write this off.
I think it was also mentioned the AFL-CIO endorsement this week. Does labor play that big of a role anymore? We've heard about the dwindling numbers. Does it play a big role in the Democratic primary at least?
It provides you field troops. Financially, it's particularly for a Pritzker who's self-funding, it's not a lot, but it always helps to have workers in every precinct in the state who can go out and push your message. And it gives you a patina, again, particularly for Pritzker, of I'm not just the rich guy from Chicago who owned a hotel chain. I'm the labor candidate. I'm for the little guy. See, the labor guys are for me. It helps.
And let's move on to our notes from the field. Brian, let's start with you.
Yeah, there was a call this week as we are still tracing the fallout from the President Trump's decision to exit the Paris Climate Accords. A number of Illinois Democrats are trying to say that the state should join other states like California and New York to sort of pick up the slack. We had all the statewide elected officials as well as Speaker Madigan, Senate President Cullerton, and a bunch of rank-and-file legislators say that Illinois ought to step up and pick up some of the slack. I have not yet seen a response from the Rauner administration on that.
Greg?
We've been talking about the state budget. The federal budget also is getting pretty hot, particularly as Trump seems to spend more and more time trying to fend off this Russia stuff that gives him less political capital spent on his budget. That broke out in the Chicago area this week when Congressman Hultgren, a Republican, made it clear that he doesn't think very much of the president's proposal to slash spending on the federal labs up in the Chicago area, Argonne and Fermi. My understanding is as many 700 jobs are on the line. I predict that you will see more and more stuff like that from Republican Congress because some of these budget cuts that the president wants really do go into constituencies that have bipartisan support.
And Charlie?
Well, we've been talking about the immediate problems facing Illinois. A state lawmaker from the Springfield area, Representative Butler, has suggested that we ought to have another constitutional convention. And he's introduced a resolution that would put before voters next November the question, should there be another constitutional convention? He argues that with all the stuff going on and in our bicentennial year, it might be a fitting time to look at the document, which, as he noted, was approved almost 50 years ago, back in 1970.
And what would it take to have that happen again?
The legislature, by 3/5 votes in each chamber, would have to approve Butler's resolution. Then it would go on the ballot in November of 2018, and if voters approved it, then we would have to organize a constitutional convention. And the Constitution says the legislature then has to set out the rules for elections of delegates, has to appropriate money. The last time this issue was before the voters and it got rejected by a 2-1 margin was back in 2008. And at the time, the estimates ranged from maybe $25 million up to as high as $100 million to pay the cost of the convention.
All right, we're going to leave it there for this week. Members of our broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Greg Hines. You can get a podcast of our show. Go to nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Just look for State Week. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.